My headache won't go away.
I get blurry vision.
My balance is awful.
I'm exhausted.
We can all get these symptoms from time to time. But if you or a loved one notice you're getting a combination of them regularly, don't ignore it. They could be signs of a brain tumour.
My headache won't go away.
I get blurry vision.
My balance is awful.
I'm exhausted.
To learn more about the common signs of a brain tumour, search Better Safe Than Tumour.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Brain Tumours, the podcast where we'll be talking to people who've been affected by a brain tumour diagnosis, either their own diagnosis or the diagnosis of a loved one. We'll also be sharing news and updates from the Brain Tumour Charity about what we're doing to halve the harm and double survival. Welcome to Let's Talk About Brain Tumours. In this episode, we're going to be joined by Elizabeth and Julia, the hosts of the podcast On a Good Day, which they started to talk about their experiences of brain injuries. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. It's an absolute delight to be here.
You're absolutely welcome. Elizabeth, can I start with you? Do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are and how you come to be in this situation?
Sure. So I'm Elizabeth Callahan. I'm a mum of two girls, a journalist, blogger. I've got a health and wellness business. I have lots of hats. And I'm also the co-host of On a Good Day, which is a new podcast, which I co-host alongside Julia. We connected after both our husbands had a brain injury. We were connected by a mutual friend. We really got so much out of the conversations that we were having, and we just thought, gosh, we need to kind of get these out to a wider audience because we know that so many other people will benefit from this. So, you know, I guess the podcast was born out of wanting others to feel more connected, less alone, and to get some more information and answers that we wanted to know. So we wanted to, you know, get that from the guests that we have on and ask those questions and, you know, get that out to a wider audience. So how did brain injury come into my life? So it was 5 years ago, my husband had a stroke. So he was 38 at the time, had been a very confident, vivacious, you know, go-getter, and had a series of medical issues. He did, you know, quite a few life-threatening conditions. You know, he's had cancer, he's had, you know, heart surgery, and this was another incident. He got a bacterial infection, went to his heart, and then had to have heart surgery, and then somewhere along the way had a stroke. So we then found that out sort of a week later. It just is completely life-changing. You know, you kind of don't realize it at the time, but everything has changed as a result of that brain injury. And it's adapting to that new way of living and connecting and us being a family, I suppose.
Absolutely. That's very young, 38, to be like, you associate strokes with much, much older people, don't you?
You do, but, you know, I guess within the work that we've done, we've come across so many people, younger people that are having strokes and brain injuries, isn't it, Julia? Because Hector was fairly young as well.
Yes, he was only 38 too, and he had a subarachnoid brain hemorrhage just over 13 years ago. I also have two children. They're 23 and 18, but at the time Hector had his subarachnoid, we were living in Nigeria and the children had just turned 5 and 10. So we were, you know, kind of life changed in lots of ways then, because they had to change school. My son had just started school and we ended up back living in with my mum's house where we still are and in the village that I grew up in. So we moved overnight from Nigeria. Hector was flown to Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge. And that's where we are today.
Do you have any sort of warnings that that might happen? Any idea, or did it just sort of come out of the blue?
Yes, out of the blue, he collapsed. And I realised that it was pretty catastrophic then. He'd been having headaches. But yes, apart from that, it was pretty out of the blue.
That's the thing, your life changes in just a blink of an eye, doesn't it? Just that you're going along in life and then suddenly just something happens. And like you said, it changes your life in ways you don't even imagine that your life is going to be changed.
Absolutely. And I think that's been the case for both of us, hasn't it?
Yeah, completely. And you don't realise it at the time. It's just, yeah, over time, things change in really lots of different ways, which I'm sure we're going to get into. But yeah, it affects every part of your life, I would say, brain injury, whatever. And it's a very wide spectrum, isn't it, of illnesses. But the communication changes, how you connect with each other, and the things that they can do, the responsibilities that you're taking on as a carer or a partner of a brain injury survivor. And for them, you know, such a different life, and their kind of emotions and getting their head around it, and you're getting your head around it. It just impacts so many people. And I think, you know, when we were thinking up On a Good Day podcast, we just thought, look, it's not just that individual, it's the whole community of people that's affected by it. And actually, if we can help strengthen those links, strengthen those people around that brain injury person, then you are empowering them more so and supporting them as a collective.
Yeah, because Andy, you've talked about that in the past, haven't you? How your brain tumor has affected your filter's gone, and sometimes you'll just blurt things out or say things that are inappropriate, and that your children have to explain to people or say things to people to prepare them for sometimes that you'll say things.
Yeah, that's true. Because I was lucky, I guess, that I can still sort of function as I did before, pretty much. And I know, listening to some of your previous podcasts, your husbands were affected quite more significantly in that sense. But for myself, it was some of the things that affect me, which may affect your husbands, about the fatigue, tinnitus, things like that, the lack of being able to sleep, and then all things that are invisible, which makes it harder when people ask you how you are. And I'm sure we'll talk about this later. When you say, how are you? And I either say I'm fine, and that covers a multitude of sins, because I haven't got the time to explain to people what's going on, or you explain to people what's actually going on. And so one of the challenges that I've got is my brain mouth filter has been impacted. I'll tend to blurt out things as I think them, which can be a bit embarrassing, dare I say. So my family know that. So they cut me some slack, if that makes sense. And they quite like it sometimes, because I will say things that are a little bit rude. But if we're out with others, I have to make a real effort almost not to speak until I'm absolutely sure what I'm going to say. So it makes casual conversation very difficult with other people, because I'm always aware that if they don't know me and it hasn't been explained to them, they might either take offense or wonder why I'm saying random words occasionally, just because I can't speak them quickly enough.
Is that something that you've honed over time then, that you've managed to kind of restrict yourself, or just be like, okay, don't talk yet? Are you formulating the sentence in your head before you speak it, rather than just blurting it out?
I try to. The challenge I've got with, and I'm guessing it's the same for your husband or your partners, is that the brain's still kind of working, but the interface is slow. I'll think something and I'll try and say it, but before the rest of my sort of mind's caught up and speaking normally, I'll blurt it out. So what I tend to do, like if I'm out in a group of people, for example, at a restaurant, I'll sit at the end of the table. So all the noise is coming in one way, and I can channel who I'm talking to much more easily, just focus on them. And then, yes, there is an element of saying, I almost sometimes have to say, look, I'm sorry. Right. And then give them the answer. And initially people think you're being a bit dim or a bit slow, if I'm allowed to say that, because you're sort of, normally I'd be like that. But when you're with other people, you have to just part of the coping mechanism is to warn them, to say, look, I may occasionally say something that's a bit inappropriate. Apologies in advance if I do. But if I really have to think about every word I'm going to say, we're not going to have a very good conversation. So I don't know whether has that been with your guys at all as well?
My husband loves a chat. And as soon as he walks in the front door, it'll be blurting stuff out. And I'm like, okay, rein that back. And because I know him, I can kind of figure out what he's saying, because a lot of the time it's not totally making sense, and I can kind of piece together. And it's especially if he's kind of tired or whatever. But it is kind of that, you know, just blurring out words, just like constantly as well. And then he can't stop talking a lot of the time. So actually, he could probably get some tips from you, Andy, on, you know, being able to kind of rein it back a bit. And sometimes I'm like, okay, stop, Paul. Like, think about what you're going to say. And sometimes I feel I'm a bit harsh doing this, but I kind of really want him to be more aware of that and to actually, learn different ways of doing it, because it's fine because it's me and I can kind of piece together what he's saying. But if you're saying that with someone else, or he wants to get back into, you know, business, if you're kind of, you know, you need to piece it together in your head before it comes out. So, yeah, sometimes I'll be like, okay, stop, think about what you're saying. Is that, you know, and then tell me.
I think there's a couple of things, Andy, that you've said that I wanted to pick up on. Actually, for my husband, Hector, it's a bit of the opposite problem, because actually he used to be much more eloquent, and now he has aphasia. So that's really affected his communication, his speech. So
was that brought on by the stroke?
Yes.
Okay.
So I think he knows exactly what he wants to say in his head, but actually he struggles to get his words out and say things in the ways he wants to. So when you were talking about being out with the noise, I think background noise is really hard. You know, when there's a lot of people and a lot of incoming sound and messages and the need to process all of that, I think that can be make it much more difficult to communicate, can't it?
So that is common. Yeah.
Yes. But the other thing that I think you said and you talked about, which really resonated for me, is this feeling of a safe space, that actually at home with your family, with your children, you can talk, you can laugh at the inappropriate things you might say, because that safe space is protected. You feel safe. Your family feels safe, that you all have that understanding. But actually when you leave that space, things change a bit. And I think that's a very shared experience, certainly for our family, that means that it's a very precious place, and that people that come into the home then become part of that. And it's important that those people who do come into us are very dear to us and precious to us in that space, because it's an understanding, and they can build their understanding as well of our shared experience of brain injury in that safe space.
And I think for me, what was important was understanding that, exactly that there's a safe space at home, and acknowledging that. And you can tell me about your guys, but I know for me it took a couple of years before I accepted that I was different from before my brain injury. Initially, I thought, I'm going to get back to be how I was. That, I realised, wasn't going to be possible. And then it's about trying to put in coping mechanisms to lessen the impact, if that makes sense, of where I was different. And one of those was exactly that. We talked about it as a family. My family is just fantastic, by the way, because they are so understanding. But we had to talk about that. And it took probably about a couple of years from me being ill and being operated on before we actually sat down and said, hang on, let's just acknowledge it. We kind of tacitly understood that, but to actually acknowledge it, not quite to the point of putting house rules up, but almost feeling that it's acceptable in that environment, for me anyway, that I can just relax. I don't have to stress about saying something that's wrong. So I don't know, have you guys had the same kind of discussions with your partners about, partly about accepting that they're different than they were before, but also how you can try and mitigate that difference and make their lives and your lives a bit more comfortable, if that's the right word?
I think we're starting to have some of those conversations. I think my husband is only just kind of getting into that acceptance part. Not sure if he's 100% there. I think I'm slightly further on now with accepting the situation. But I think for him, he's, you know, sometimes he does, but sometimes he doesn't.
It's a grieving process, isn't it? Because there's this whole life that you have planned out that's now not going to be lived, and the life that you are going to live, both of you, him as an individually but also as a couple and a family, there's a whole life that isn't going to happen now, and a different life is going to happen, and there's a grief and loss in that, isn't there, of letting go of what you thought and accepting now what is.
Yeah, a massive, massive grieving process, which continues. It continues on, and it's finding ways of accepting that and being like, okay, that never happened. it's not going to happen. We'll recreate. Mm-hmm. What life are we going to recreate?
Yeah.
How are we going to work with this? And there's definitely work that we are doing, or starting to do on that. I think 5 years on, it really, really is a process. For Paul, I think the whole work thing, changing that has been something that he has struggled with. He wants to do something in some capacity, something purposeful within his family business, but it's kind of finding out what and how he can fit into that. So it's constantly evolving, really.
Yeah, and I think coming back to the point about communication as well, I think, yes, we have had those conversations and they've changed over time. My children, as I said in the beginning, were 5 and 10 when Hector had his brain hemorrhage, and now they're 18 and 23. But I think that the foundation that we had for that communication of having really difficult conversations that you don't want to have with your young children, and them mm-hmm. going into the environment of hospital or not on some occasions, and talking about some of the realities of what was going on, and then also over time and them understanding that dad was struggling with this or was a bit different than other dads and what that might mean and reasons for that. But I think what that did was give a foundation for those deeper kind of conversations as we've all aged over the last 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And what I hope that's done, what I think it's done, is enabled us to have sometimes difficult conversations even now, and about other things as well. And I think that's actually been one of the gifts of our situation, that it's enabled us to understand how important that communication is, and maybe be a little bit better than we might have been with those difficult conversations.
Completely agree with that. And but it takes time to come to terms with that. And I mean, Elizabeth, you're saying it's 5 years now. I think Paul's a lot younger than I was, I guess. So I'd kind of got to the start. I was 52 when I was rushed to hospital, wondering what the heck was going on in my life. So I didn't have a career to worry about because I was already on the downward slope. Whereas with your partner, it's a lot harder because he's probably still thinking, that was my first reaction, weirdly, was apart from have I got a passport, because I need a passport to go to hospital with, no idea where that came from, was how am I going to pay for my family? And it's those things. But in time, you get there. So maybe you're at a more difficult, challenging stage of life, I guess, because Paul would expect, I'm imagining, to be the main breadwinner, and that's going to be a challenge for him. But it's just having that ability to talk about it. And this is where this might help others who are listening to this. Just there are many families who have partners with brain injuries. It's understanding that you're not alone, and that having these really difficult conversations is the norm and is to be encouraged. And it's quite easy to shy away from that and just muddle through, and you muddle through and you muddle through, and 5 years later you're still muddling through, and you think, hang on, let's just have a conversation now that would make, like, we sat down when I finally got my head around the fact that I was different, and we talked about, right, what are we going to do, not just with the life that I've got left, but things like holidays. Can I still go on holiday? Can we go on holiday? How do we communicate as a family? How do we give myself that safe space? And it's really, life has improved for me a lot since having those sorts of conversations. But it's not an overnight process, and it's going to be a challenge, I guess, but it's one that hopefully people listening to this realize they're not alone in that situation.
As a carer for somebody in that situation, how does that affect your relationships? Because you have a certain dynamic in relationships, and then suddenly you very much take on a very different role.
Yes, hesitation there from both of us.
I thought I'd let you go first. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's such a loaded question, isn't it? Because it's such a big question. I certainly think that being a carer alongside being a wife is challenging at times where there is a change in roles and responsibilities, and that's not always welcomed by me having those additional roles or Hector not having them. I think also trying to manage our relationship so that we are both supportive of each other within what we can do, and maintaining to me something that's very important is the respect that goes with the love as well, so that we can make sure that we are respectful of each other's capabilities, roles and responsibilities. And then in some of the day-to-day things, I mean, I have to do a lot of form filling and communicating and things, you know, that kind of life admin that I don't like doing. Does anyone like doing it? I don't know.
I was going to say, does anyone like doing it? But then when somebody's got any kind of illness or anything, it suddenly quadruples and you're suddenly left with lots and lots more than normal.
Absolutely. And, you know.
Were you given any support with that, Elizabeth, in terms of sort of migrating from the relationship you had to where you're effectively being a carer as well? Were you given any help or guidance or support, or have you kind of had to work it all out yourself?
No, and I actually looked for some family counselling at the time, because I felt at that when we were still really in a crisis situation, or when Hector first came out of hospital, which I think was still part of that, he was in hospital for 5 months. But having two young children, his care needs, our relationship, I was really struggling then. But I was unable to find any services that could help us specifically. It wasn't just that I wanted counselling, it was specifically looking at all of those dynamics. And no, I couldn't find anyone that I thought we could talk to as a family to help us navigate some of that. I got involved in the carers realm. I used some carer support services and kind of got involved in some carer representation in Cambridgeshire, which was great and very helpful for me at the time. And we know that it can take a long time for people to allow themselves to receive that support, because often people don't want to identify as being a carer or don't do that for some time. I think for me, once I did that, enabled me to access that support, which I hadn't done before. But also I then withdrew from that because as I got back to work and as our situation changed, I felt that I was no longer really being the voice of carers, many of whom were carers that were caring for either children or partners where their situation wasn't going to change or maybe was going to get worse. So I stepped away from that. But I did find that very supportive at the time. And obviously I still identify as a carer, because I think that there are lots of parts of my role that I wouldn't be doing if I wasn't in that caring role.
Yeah, I think there are, like Julie was saying, you are taking on a lot more responsibility. It is all those things, like you say, that you don't necessarily want to do on top of everything else that life throws at you and your work and looking after a house. And I've got two children, young children, so they are now 10 and 6. And at the time, they were almost 2 and 6. So really young. So had my hands full, certainly at the beginning, looking after them. And I still do. Gosh, it just gets busier and busier, the amount of activities. And the thing, like, so my husband can't drive, so I'm like always the designated driver, which is fine. But sometimes you're like, you know, you're driving to a kid's party, you're driving back, you're taking them to whatever activities they've got, drama or whatever, and picking them up from school. And so, yeah, I do feel like a glorified taxi driver a lot.
And that's the thing, that when you didn't know this was going to happen, you planned to do this as a couple, as a partnership. You didn't think you'd effectively be doing all of those things on your own, that it would be a shared responsibility, presumably.
And Paul used to do a lot before his stroke. He took on a lot of that responsibility, actually, with the children. He would look after, you know, a lot of the financial stuff. He kind of, you know, he really liked having that control, actually kind of doing that. And now he doesn't. It really, really frustrates him, actually, in terms, you know, for some of those things, particularly kind of some of the admin things and financial things. With the kids, he is really reconnecting with them. And I'm kind of empowering him by, you know, just leaving him to it on a lot of occasions. I'm back freelancing in my journalism work. So that's allowing him to take them to school, pick them up from school, giving him ownership over that, making their dinners and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I'm not there. It's not mummy. What really annoyed him, I suppose, for a while, it's like, oh, it's all mummy all the time. What about daddy? there was that disconnect. Mm-hmm. Now you have to talk to them. You have to do stuff with them. You can't just sit there and like expect the relationship to evolve. So it's kind of forced him to have those connections, to chat with them, to spend time with them, to read their books and together and all that sort of thing, you know, make their dinner. And then that's kind of, you know, a whole other thing. And I'm not there to see anything. I kind of just get home and the house is in whatever state it's in. But the kids are fed. Sometimes they're in their pajamas. You know, he's done a good job. He's, you know, he's trying. It's allowing him and giving him the space to feel purposeful and to take ownership. And it's really helpful. It is really helpful.
I think one thing with that question as well, Sarah, that I'm mindful of is that actually there's lots of single parents who are doing all of these things on their own anyway.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, I often think about that change role and, you know, when I have additional duties and think about, you know, single parents who are doing it all on their own. I guess one of the things, though, that I think we then navigate when we are still in our relationships is when are we helping and when are we being obstructive, and trying to facilitate often that helping out and that kind of equality in a partnership. And so I think that's where some of the additional responsibilities lie as well, is that,
yeah,
is that kind of navigating that space where we want to still be able to facilitate our partners to do as much as they can, but that also takes work.
It really does.
And, yeah.
And dealing with their emotions as well. And, you know, sometimes there is that conflict that's going to come up in any kind of relationships anyway. Yeah. But when you have, you know, somebody who can't do what he used to do, really wants to be able to, and gets, you know, angry, annoyed, frustrated, it's and can be sometimes negative about it, you know, about our life in general. You know, it's managing all those emotions as well.
Both your husbands were very young when they had their brain injuries. You know, Andy touched on it, but when you're that age, our careers are so much part of our identity, you know, what we do. Like Andy said, he was getting to the end of that where it was becoming less so. For your husbands, that change, that shift of who am I if I'm not this, who am I if I'm not that, is kind of another layer that comes onto it, because they've now got to reestablish their identity, recreate an identity within that.
Yes, and also I think being confident enough in that new identity now to role model. I mean, you know, my husband for my son, and I think is an amazing role model, but it's not through the career that he might have had, but actually it's through the fact that he gets up every day and engages and does all the things that he is able to do and pushes himself to do that, and we all see that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the successes of a life get measured on different things.
Yeah. And how far they've come. And, you know, it's very much who is to say that success is measured by, you know, achievements, mm-hmm, career, whatever. That's just a perspective, isn't it? And it, like, I kind of look at Paul and I think, gosh, how inspiring for them to see somebody that, you know, was almost died, was couldn't walk, talk, speak, you know, talk and speak are the same, but walk, talk, and, you know, have conversations that are coherent. And here he is, you know, living, breathing, and, you know, every day is going out and trying to be more and keep improving himself. He wants to progress and keep doing, you know, doing stuff. I mean, talking about some of the facilities that or help or support that we've had. I at the beginning, I didn't really, unlike Julia, have or look for kind of that support necessarily. I think it was a few years down the line where I thought, actually, I'm quite open now to maybe talking to somebody. And actually, a local charity, which is amazing, is called INS, Integrated Neurological Services. They have been incredible in providing Paul with some great courses. He's doing a creative writing one. He's doing like a mindfulness course. It kind of goes out the window. Sometimes he's like, we just did some meditation. I'm like, okay, can you do that a bit more? So you're not like...
Especially when I get home, yeah.
You feel the effects a bit more. So that's been great. But also they provided someone for me to talk to as well. And that was really...
That's really good.
Great, yeah. So just to talk through things and what I... You know, my experiences in a really safe space, somebody that I obviously didn't know. And they have carers weeks that they put on as well, like once a month they bring the carers all together. So that I've been really, really grateful that that service has been available for us. And I know a lot of places don't have that, but I'm really, really grateful that that's there for us to tap into.
And I think that's really important because it's terrible for the person that's got the brain injury, but the person that's caring for them, often there's a huge gap in between what is offered, what support is out there or even thought of. It doesn't even come up in conversations like, how are you coping?
Yes, and I think that's on a good day and with our podcast, it's that acknowledgement that actually if we are all better informed, if we are all coping better, then the outcomes for our loved ones who've been affected by brain injury are also going to be better.
It's just understanding. It's understanding their situation is them understanding our situation better. I think through some of our episodes, it's made Paul maybe realise a little bit about, you know.
I was just about to ask, do they listen to your podcast?
They did come on one as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they did one with us. And yes, got no option. He's got to listen to it. But no, he's actually getting loads out of it, actually, out of listening. Yeah, it's been really beneficial for him.
Now, I had that as well with the charity podcasts, because I've done a couple talking about sort of challenges with living with a brain injury. And my kids, they're all in their 20s now, but they've each said, wow, Dad, I didn't realise what you were having to put up with on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And also to my wife saying, hey, Mum, amazed you're having to deal with Dad who's doing that on a daily basis. Mm. And I think that really helps, because through the podcast, you can just explain more about the challenges of either being a carer or being someone with a brain injury. And it is different. I mean, I was just going to quickly go back to the bit about part of accepting that you're different is also for both the carer and the person with the brain injury is accepting that success is now measured in a different way. So success up to when your partner's had their injuries probably measured in a certain way. Now it's measured in a different way. I do occasionally have that with my kids. They don't communicate too much with me, but that's kids. When they sort of say, hey, Dad, I didn't realise that just going out and functioning for you is actually quite a big deal. They just assume because I was loud and leery beforehand that I would be now. And I had one specific where I went to Thorpe Park last October for Fright Night and actually went on a couple of the rides. Now, whether that was wise or not, I don't know, but I was with my kids and it was fantastic because I was with them and I felt like a dad again, like I used to. But they were sort of saying, understanding what I was having to deal with, they said, are you sure, Dad, you want to go on that? And when I came off and they both gave me a massive big hug and said, wow, we realized how hard that was for you. So having those new measures or different measures of success post the injury is vital, I think, for both the carers and the person involved, so that you can, rather than saying, oh, you used to be able to do that, why can't you do it anymore? You can say, wow, you've done that. Well done. And also for the carers as well, because, like you said, you're having to do a lot more than you probably signed up for better phrase, for better or worse, I know. But so it's recognising for you guys that, so if you can get your husband maybe to slow down when he's talking, when you come home, that's actually a sign of success that you're having a positive impact on him. And it's trying to measure those little increments of success, I think, is important for you and the carers and the people being cared for.
And I think communicating them as well, like, looping back to communication, actually saying to each other, thank you, that was brilliant, that was great, that wasn't so great, that was really hard for me. I think those, following up those times with that communication, which, of course, a great big hug to dad says a million words as well, doesn't it? So, yeah, I think that's really powerful.
Small steps.
One thing I did want to just say that I think I do find difficult in this new experience is having the sole not the sole responsibility, but decision making, carrying more responsibility in making decisions, but also in trying to make that equitable in terms of our decision making. But then also managing risk, I feel, in terms of some of the decision-making that I'm called upon to make. So I was interested in you saying, Andy, you went to Thorpe Park, because I'm really nervous about that. My husband's had some pretty major seizures, and, I just don't know whether that's a good thing to do or not. Because I drive, we haven't been to Thorpe Park on a ride, but maybe, do you know what I mean? Just in terms of that responsibility of, I don't want to stop Hector doing things, but also I am actively making decisions around managing risk or what we do to try and enable him to do as much as possible, but also to manage the risk. And I sometimes find that a lot of responsibility, and I don't know the answers to some things.
Would he want to go to Thorpe Park?
I'm sure he'd love it.
I don't think Paul would. I wouldn't want to go with him. It would be so stressful, especially with two young children.
And
maybe when they're grown up, you'd be all right.
Well, that'd be different.
My goodness, the thought.
But it's managed risk, isn't it?
You're absolutely right, Julia. And it's how much do you manage their risk for them, and almost like wrap them in cotton wool.
Yes.
And how much do you let them feel? I'm probably a bit more, I don't know, at the stage of life where I've always wanted to occasionally do daft things. And my family know that, and my wife knows that. Just once or twice, just do something daft that reminds myself that I'm alive, and I can be a bit irresponsible. So if your husband's like that, then occasionally he likes to just do something a bit silly, then I'd encourage it. Let him go. He'll probably get so much pleasure out of doing something that he probably thought he couldn't do beforehand that I guess it would outweigh the risks. And if something does go wrong, then you'll know not to do it again.
We have talked about positive risk taking in one of our podcast episodes, and we are doing more of that. And one friend said she is going to take Hector to Thorpe Park. I don't think I'm going to go. That's my solution. They can go together, and I'll stay at home.
And I hope the phone doesn't ring.
Turn the phones off and just be like, I'm in denial.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Gosh.
What advice would you give somebody who they've just suddenly found themselves in a position where their partner has got brain injury and they're wondering, oh my God, how am I going to deal with this? That first moment of crisis when it happens.
Stay calm. Like, it's not the worst. It's not, you don't know what the future holds. Really take it one day at a time. Really, you can overthink things that haven't happened. I think believe in them, staying positive where possible, because, if you're in the situation where you're in hospital surrounded by a lot of medical staff, they can be really negative and they can tell you oh, he'll never be able to do this. Or I know they kind of have to give you the worst case scenario, but you just know that that is medical speak and they don't know that person. Mm-hmm. They're looking statistically or in their experience, but they don't know your husband. And when Paul was in a coma for sort of 6 weeks, at least 6 weeks, at some points they were being, incredibly kind of negative about his chances of survival. And I just turned around and I said, look, you don't know my husband. He is going to make it. He is, he's a fighter and he will keep fighting. So don't allow them to kind of dampen your dreams or your husband. Like, stand up for your husbands, I think, or your partners or whoever it is, those loved ones. and just take your time, you know, allow yourself to go through those emotions, and it will, sometimes things catch up with you later on. It didn't hit me for probably 3 years afterwards about kind of the enormity of the situation, because sometimes you just keep going. You are in denial, and, you know, be patient. It's not, and it's okay to not be perfect, to do things wrong and to get angry at them sometimes or have that conflict. But like you say, it is keeping that communication and being kind to yourself as well, because you're taking on so much responsibility. But look for support, I think, friends, family. Don't be afraid to ask for help.
Yes, I think my key points, and I think there are different things at the point of crisis from further down the line, but certainly I think taking one day at a time was the best advice I was ever given, because it's too frightening to look too far ahead. So taking one day at a time, asking for help. I was not used to asking for help. I didn't really know how to do it. I resisted it for a little bit, but not for very long, because it became quite quickly apparent that I needed help. So I think not struggling with any guilt around that and asking for help when you need it. Trying to keep some time for yourself to just take a breath, take a step back, to keep rested, so that you are there. And that's very difficult. I was told at hospital, you know, you're not going to help by being here 24 hours a day. Go back and get some rest. And of course, you don't want to, but I think that was very good advice. So trying to do that.
Keep you healthy, because, you know, I was very aware that I was having to keep the whole family together.
Yeah.
So in some ways, I kind of threw myself into making sure that I was as fit and as healthy as I could to get through those really tough times when it does take it out of you.
Yeah. And I think just another couple of sort of longer term ones are find points of connection. Where are the points that when it seems that actually you've lost things that you used to do together, where are the things that you can do together? And also focusing on the things that your loved one or the person you're caring for can do, and not necessarily what they can't do. And I think that provides a foundation.
Very good advice. Yeah, I'm constantly saying to Paul, stop telling me what you can't do. What can you do? So yeah, it's really drilling that in and empowering them to realise, look at all the stuff.
As a carer, to focus on that, I think, too.
It's been amazing talking to you both. Before we wrap up, you've got your podcast. We've mentioned it a few times. Do you want to just give us a little bit of an overview about your podcast, what it is and where people can find it?
Of course. So people can listen to the podcast. We're on A Good Day. So on wherever you would usually get your podcasts from. You can follow us on Instagram, onagood.day, Twitter, onagood_day. And I'm sure you'll put all this in the show notes as well. Yeah. You know, this is it's for anybody really affected by brain injury. Obviously, our perspectives is from somebody who has a partner who has a brain injury. But really, we're really delving into all those kind of questions that we would like to get answered, that our partners are probably curious about as well. Helping people to get more informed, because the more informed you are about the situation, about other people's, you know, stories and how they're feeling, then the more you can empathize and help that person to, you know, empower them to be the best that they can be, and for you to as well, because, you know, looking after somebody with a brain injury, as we have discussed, it does change your life. It changes the responsibilities. You're living a slightly different life, but that's okay. You're creating your new stories. Things happen in life, don't they? And it's building that resilience and, you know, staying positive, being the light in the storm, giving it time and feeling all those emotions as well.
Yes, and I think it's great that you at the Brain Tumor Charity have also got a podcast, because I think it is a platform that people are increasingly using, and people can pick and choose what is the most helpful to them. And so thank you very much for having us on today as well.
Really, really grateful for you inviting us on. So thank you so much, and for all the great work that you guys are doing. Your charity is just amazing, and you know, helping so many others, and for those people with brain tumors, brain injuries, and their families as well. It's incredible.
if anyone is listening, all the details for Elizabeth and Julia will be in the show notes and linked to On a Good Day as well. So if you just go down to the show notes, it'll all be in there for you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss an episode. If you'd like more information, you can visit our website at thebraintumorcharity.org or email our support team at support@thebraintumorcharity.org. And finally, before you go, if you enjoyed this podcast, please can you leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts so we can reach more people and raise more awareness.
Hi, I'm Tamsin and I work in the individual giving team at the Brain Tumour Charity. Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. If you or a loved one have been diagnosed with a brain tumour and are worried about your finances, the Brain Tumour Charity's Benefits and Money Advice Clinic, run in partnership with Citizens Advice, is here to help you. Our expert advisors can help you access the financial support you're entitled to, as well as give advice on how to make the most of your money. To make an appointment with our Benefits and Money Advice Clinic, visit our website at thebraintumorcharity.org/money or call our support team on 0808 800 0004.